Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. The Obama administration, as part of their effort to improve our healthcare system, is pushing for more electronic interconnectivity among its constituents. As with all endeavors, there are risks and benefits to be weighed. Today, we're going to be discussing this effort and what is being done in Alaska with Dr. Jerome List, Dr. Tom Nicewander, and Rebecca Madison. In Anchorage, if you've got questions or comments, you can call us at 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And you can email us at line1, spell it all out, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at kska.org. Tom, Jerome, and Rebecca. Rebecca's joining us by telephone from Fairbanks, but Dr. Nicewander and Dr. Lister in the studio. Welcome to Line One.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Thanks for having us.
Yes, thank you. We're
going to talk about a national initiative, and there is a Alaska response, I guess is a way to say. And before we get into a little bit about the national initiative and why, let's talk about two of the organizations that are trying to help the follow-through on this this national initiative. Jerome, Dr. List, would you mind talking to us about the Alaska eHealth or EMR Alliance and what it's all about?
Well, the Alaska Electronic Health Record Alliance is a nonprofit group that formed in 2005. And it was basically another physician in Anchorage got together and said, you know, we need to do something because we need some technology to help health information exchange and make it available to different physicians. And so we got together one night and started discussing what were some of the barriers for adoption and why physicians weren't using this enough, and decided to create this nonprofit organization. And the other physician is Dr. Rich Neubauer, who is still working here in town and still part of the Electronic Health Record Alliance. And so for the first several years, it was a bit of a rough go. We didn't have a lot of support. We didn't have a lot of funding. We didn't have a lot of direction, actually, other than knowing that this technology was going to be important and it was forthcoming. And we needed in some way, form, or fashion to help our local community of physicians and healthcare providers to be able to adopt this technology. And so as we have aligned ourselves, as it turns out, there's been a great deal of interest developing in the past year or so regarding the use of technology for maintaining electronic health records for patients. And so we've started to become a little bit more the center of attention for the promotion and implementation of some of this technology. So that's how we were initially started, and that's partially where we are today.
So a grassroots kind of organization before much national initiative.
Correct.
And now has gotten a lot more attention because of the national goals. Rebecca, there's also the organization, the Alaska eHealth Network. How does that different from the Alliance, and what's its history?
Well, the Alaska eHealth Network actually has been around for a long time. It started out as the Telehealth Advisory Council back in 1996, and they were working on broadband issues and telemedicine projects. And gradually over time, as technologies changed, they became more interested in how to actually start exchanging the data. And at that point in 2005, they formed a group that they re-transformed themselves as the Alaska RIO and started looking at ways to share health data across providers and from providers to patients. And out of that grew the Alaska eHealth Network. We work hand in glove with the Alaska EHR Alliance. They're sort of the private physician and provider side, and we're more the hospital and the payer side. And together we work to ensure that everybody is exchanging data both securely and with standards so that one system can read what another system has. So the Alaska eHealth Network, or AHN as we call it, AEHN, is really working on the transport of that data and how to do that securely and with the proper controls in place and standards to do the transfer of the data. You'll hear different terms talked about today, and I just want to go through four of them because they're really critical. HIT is Health Information Technology, and that's really the tools and processes necessary to gather this data and do comprehensive management of the information that comes out of the data. Then Health Information Exchange, which is what the AHIN does, is actually the electronic movement of the data between patients, providers, and organizations according to standards. Then you'll hear EMR often, the electronic medical record. That was the original electronic record. It did not share data. The newer term, EHR, or electronic health record, is a broader concept where data actually can be moved in and out of the record and can also be utilized to provide quality measurements of what's going on with the data. So that's kind of a little overview of the AHIN. We are in the process right now of working on a contract to actually provide those services to any provider in the state, as well as we have received funds from the federal government to help providers implement their EHRs.
And Thad, let me add, so on the board are all the major players in the state. They're in the healthcare business. Jerome and I are both on the board representing the physician community, but the VA is there, the hospital association, insurance payers. So we've got a broad AARP mm-hmm. is there, Commonwealth mm-hmm. North is there as two consumer representatives. So we have a broad based board for setting policy and moving forward.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Tom. That's right.
Yeah. Mm. What I would like to do next, and unless you guys want to say some more about what we're the structure here with these two organizations, is talk about the national initiative and why it's necessary and what the hopes and promises are. And the reason I'm mentioning that is I've already had a caller in, and I want her to hold on because I think we need to get some framework here, and then we'll get into some specific issues. So who wants to tell me why this hasn't been done in the past and why it's being done now, and what are the reasons and what are the hopes?
Well, let me take a stab at it, Thad. I mean, I tell people if we had been in the banking business, we had all been out of business a long, long time ago. We've been, as all the three of us know here, and many of the folks are on the audience, whether they're physicians or patients, we've been a wash in paper, mm-hmm. and it has not worked well in terms of lost information you can't read. Even in the hospital's storing of the information, I'm over at the Native Hospital, and we've got cradle-to-grave records, and we had some charts that are weighing 12 and 14 pounds. It's absolutely impossible. People can't believe. In fact, when we did community surveys in Alaska as part of the eHealth Network piece, the public assumed that we had electronic records. No one believed it. We're still doing handwritten notes yet, but it's impossible. I think that the reluctance has been as expensive. Frankly, the technology has not been there. There's somewhere around 250 electronic health record vendors. Some of it has been vaporware. The very earliest exposure that people and early adopters had, physicians had taken on electronic medical records, it was a failure. They had great expense. But finally, I think with all this discussion and starting actually in the Bush administration about the cost of health care, the efficiency of health care, they set a goal of establishing electronic health records and health information system across the country by 2014. A very, very aggressive timetable that, frankly, I don't think will be achieved. But it was a recognition in major health groups like Kaiser, and you hear about group health out of Puget Sound, Cleveland Clinic, the Mayo Clinic, that we had to move beyond just this individual snail mail referrals, and now especially now, we've got so much data related to patients, more than we've ever had before. This has not been organized, and the national initiative, it's included in some of the health reform stuff. It's been augmented by that. They established a national office of the national coordinator to really spearhead this effort. It still, frankly, is a work in progress. It's as you'll probably find out. I don't know. That's my anybody. I don't know, Jerome or Rebecca.
Well, I might just chime in a little bit, and I just say that this is not entirely new, again, I remember President Bush stating that he wanted every American citizen to have an electronic health record by 2014. And so this has been talked about for a long time. I think I might disagree a little bit with Dr. Niswanger, because I think technology has been around and has been available. We just haven't gotten organized enough to be able to properly utilize it. On the other side of this being a national push towards going in this direction, I have a little bit of concern about the medical community, because I still think that the medical community itself should have been more proactive in doing this. Physicians have typically complained when the federal government is the one who dictates how we should practice medicine or what technology we should use for medicine. So, as we go through this today, I might kind of take a little bit of a negative side on this, just to say that I poke at our own organization, our own group, or at our own profession, basically to say that we need to be proactive in this. We need to be doing this. We shouldn't be depending on the federal government to tell us how to do this. I think to incentivize us and push us in that direction, I think is very good. But we should be dictating how this is done on an actual practical basis.
Rebecca, any comments?
I'd agree with both of those statements. I think the complexity of healthcare has made it a slower technology to move forward. But I think Dr. List is right. You know, it takes the providers to actually drive the technology in the direction it needs to go.
I want to ask one question, and I've got Diane Holden on the line. I want to get to hers, but along the same line, and that is that in 1996, I got my first electronic medical record in my office, and what I was being told at that time is it would not take long. All we needed to do was get the government. Somebody had to establish a protocol, a way of having protected information for physicians to transmit information to each other and to labs and to hospitals and to radiologists and so forth, and then we'd be on the way. And so my bias, because I haven't heard any different, is that no one ever developed that protocol, that mechanism that was going to be safe, which I assume is what happens within the banking industry and is what's happening in other major industries. Is that right or is that wrong?
Yeah, no, I think this. What you're referencing, one of the issues, Thad, is standards.
Uh-huh.
Standards of what the information is going to look like, how it gets passed, and that has been slow in coming,
uh-huh.
and it's currently not completed yet. Some of these standards are still being developed, so that definitely was one. Quite honestly, when we did public forums in Juneau and Anchorage, Kotzebue, Fairbanks, and there's been a big issue around privacy and security from the public, and appropriately
mm-hmm.
so.
Mm-hmm.
So having those safeguards in place and over secure networks is
let me play the devil's advocate.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah,
the same
sure.
thing is true of banking. Nobody wants everybody to know what their banking information is or their Internal Revenue Service things are, and they didn't have any trouble getting everything online.
No, they haven't. No, that's true. That's absolutely true. I think that the and there are breaches,
mm-hmm.
and they have mechanisms in place, and we've probably all been called by our credit card company because they've got that system worked out well.
More than I want to be called.
Yeah,
yeah right.
And one of the things that surprised me, I mean, in talking to the public, because is that people thought their paper record was secure. And we all know that it's not. You know, the people have access to the paper record. So, but the privacy and security thing, and every time there's a breach, we hear it again.
Well, yeah, you just can't help but ask, you know, the everybody else in the private sector moved pretty quick. Medicine kind of still trying to figure out this timeline's too quick for us, you know.
Dark ages, yeah.
Let's go ahead and take a phone call if we can. Diane, I want to say thanks for hanging on so long. What can we do for you?
Well, I know at least one of your guests has heard my story before. I always make a point of making to get copies of my records, and some of the doctors are they make it a practice of also sending a follow-up letter explaining what's been going on or what their belief is of what we should be doing and the issue. However, I don't think that the electronic medical records has quite gotten to the point where the client can edit the mistakes. And believe me, there are lots and lots of mistakes that can be really quite dangerous, such as my records say that I have fewer body parts than I really do. And I'm an inch and a half shorter than I really am, so that makes my BMI index into the obesity range. And one record says, actually, I'm 10 pounds lighter, which I haven't been since I was 16, and I also am 10 years younger. So what are the safeguards to allow the clients to not only be allowed, but actually they should actually edit their data?
Yeah, it's a very, very interesting and appropriate question. Who wants to handle that one?
Well, I'll
take that if you'd like.
Yeah, go ahead.
It's an excellent point, Diane, and I agree with you 100%. And one of the things we're looking at and what we've requested from the vendors that we're looking at the software for is that we have that capability for patients to add their information in and correct it. Now, understanding that audit purposes require us to keep the original data that was generated from the source where it was generated. However, you can make the corrections into the file, and that's one of the things that we're really looking at because we believe that will make the record much better if the patient has some control over that.
But we can't just have a note at the very bottom saying, oh, by the way, this person really has these body parts and is really this age and this height, because sometimes those are automatically programmed into things such as a stress echocardiograms, and that can't just be a note at the bottom. It's got to be really changed.
Exactly. It needs to be highlighted right up front that there is something that the patient has adjusted on this record.
And it would probably occur within the appropriate section of the medical record, Diane, with a note that it had been changed, the record had been changed, but changed by you. That's current.
Okay.
That's my understanding of it, Jerome. I don't know if you've heard anything differently. I mean,
correct. And I want to focus on a little bit of a different. You know, it pertains to this a little bit, but some of the practices of physicians who are utilizing electronic health records have made a habit of having data entry while they're in the exam room, and so one of the advantages that they say is that they can do this right in front of the patient, and so the patient can verify whether this information is correct or not. And so I've tried to do that in my own personal practice, but it gets to be very impersonal. I mean, I can't have an interactive session with a patient while they're continually looking at the computer screen, making sure that their body parts are correct or their BMI is correct and what have you. And so these issues are not simple to resolve. They're not easy to correct, even though we're very much aware of that. We hear very clearly what the consumer's concern is. And the bottom line is, I still think that the patient is responsible for their own health care, and I think that the medical records belongs to the individual, and there should be some way of allowing patients to do that. Yeah. Personal health information systems, which are basically web-based, are available today. For instance, Microsoft has developed a system, and Google. The American Medical Association, it originally was one of the original ones to do that. Some of those systems allow patients to go in and edit and modify certain things. Others do not. So part of those privileges are it's a decision process. Should we let somebody come in here and modify this, or should we not? And there's not a uniform thought on that, on how we should handle that that process. But it is a concern, and I certainly share your concern.
The all we've in the requirements we have for exchange. One of the requirements is a patient portal to their medical record, so that they would have online basic access to their medical record. In fact, can see what's written there.
Yeah, and I don't want to keep this going. But I mean, there's also the possibility the patient would change the record in a way that would be unethical.
Correct.
And so there are problems on both sides here.
That's exactly right. I mean, that would be, I think that that's, it's helpful because you would have the audit. And really for sensitive, I think I know my patients well enough, and I know that some of the stuff in their record that's true that they would like to have changed.
Right.
And I would be able to pick that up if they attempted to change it.
Right.
So at least I would know that the attempt was there. So it is, that is on the other side of the issue, although in many ways, I'd rather err on correcting these, just absolutely
abominable
and wrong information.
Yep.
That's
yep.
right.
Yep.
Diane? Not that you're 10 years younger, Diane, but that's, that one's an okay one.
Thanks for your call, Diane.
Thank you.
So Diane's exactly right. Physicians make mistakes in putting the information in various ways. Hear it wrong, record it wrong.
Yep.
And once it's in there, we can't. We can change it, but it's got to be very clear that why it was changed, when it was changed, who changed it, and so forth for medical legal purposes. Gary, you're on line one.
Yeah, is this Dr. Woodard?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for the program, and thanks for having me on. Say, I want to make a few comments regarding electronic documentation. I've been a patient of the VA system here in Anchorage probably for the past 30 years, and I'd like a comment from your guests. I believe that the VA was probably the gold standard as far as electronic medical records. These folks started at least 10 or 15 years ago and, decided they were going to completely have their whole system based on, electronically on computer. And I just have to comment as a patient how incredibly well the system works. And, I kind of have to argue with one of your guests here. I don't know his name, but he made a comment about software and the fact that, there's these multiple vendors and so forth. I'm curious why more people don't go toward the government system, meaning the VA, and accept, systems that those guys have.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, so good experience with the VA system, and I'll edit this. I keep getting this feedback that the VA has made a huge improvement in quality, and are doing a wonderful, wonderful job, and people aren't enough aware of it. I may not be 100. I don't have the documentation, but boy, I keep hearing it from people I trust that there's been a major change.
They've gone up and down, through the years.
But it's an example of how government can do some things pretty damn well. Right,
Right.
Okay.
And but I hear your guests kind of poo-pooing the government side of things.
I don't think so.
No, you're absolutely right. The VA has been one of the gold standards around the country, and the national demonstration of this, and they got credit for this, is when Katrina wiped out all the paper records down in New Orleans. It didn't happen to the VA patients down there. They had access to their medical records when they moved to Baylor, Houston, and everything. So it was around. It was pretty impressive, and they've been working on this system. It's the same. It's a very similar system. Actually, the Indian Health Service, many of the tribal systems up here have adopted that system. I'm quite familiar with it, and it does work, and it is very good. Mm-hmm. And there was a political, the political reason, I think, that it's not been adopted by a larger the larger community, and the political reason was that private vendors didn't want a free system. There's a lot of money in electronic medical yeah. records, and as I mentioned before, we have these vendors. There's been some pushback to make it available. At one time, it was going to be made available, and then all of a sudden that disappeared. But
yeah, and I understand what you're saying, and I think the problem in the past with medical software has been this constant reinvention of the wheel. People don't take the things that have actually worked and incorporated those things, and I believe it's money driven, like you say. I'll hang up real quick here. I just want to mention one other thing that's connected with the VA system. Like I say, I've been a patient of theirs for 30 years, and they also give me the ability to get online and manage my own health profile, as far as if there's anything that's not accurate, I can go ahead and correct that or put in some kind of request that would be looked at. The other thing is the pharmacy is so incredibly good. I can go online and click the medicines I need a refill on, and it is so smooth that, the mailman shows up in 10 days with the exact medicines I need. So, from my standpoint, it works wonderfully.
So it can be done in a very, very large organization.
We're going to put you on the poster.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I agree.
Thank you. Can
we quote you?
Thank you for the comment. That's wonderful.
And that's exactly.
Well, I really think you need to compliment the VA.
Very well. Yeah. Rebecca had a comment.
Thanks for your comment, Gary.
That's exactly what we want to do, Gary, for the rest of the state, so that we're all on the gold standard.
Okay, thanks for your call. Margie, you're on line one.
Yes, thank you. I've actually been involved in information management for the energy industry for many years. And one of the things that people don't realize is very few IT implementations are successful. I think there's a couple of studies out there that rank about 20% of IT implementations are actually successful, delivering all the functionality. And one of the things we found in the energy industry is that users don't trust the information in the database, much like some of the callers today. So one of the things that we've done in the energy industry is make sure that the people that are actually using the system day in and day out are heavily involved in that implementation, because too many times management or perhaps the IT department doesn't really understand on a day-to-day basis what's happening. So I think the last caller had it very had it correct in that he can get in and request changes. It doesn't mean the changes are going to be made. But people, if they can't get in and have an effective system that they can use, and if a vendor is mainly talking to the management team and not going out and talking to the end users, you can have some very expensive implementations that fail.
Very good.
Boy, that's a really good point, Marjorie. That's something that we have to think about all the time. And we have large user groups around the state that we're working with. But anybody who's interested should get in contact with us.
At the beginning, Tom, did you say there are users, the public involved in your network, or is it just...
Yes, we do. On the board, we have the two kind of consumer representation that we have has been the AARP and Commonwealth North.
Okay.
And so at the kind of the policy at that level, we're working really at the board level, at the 100,000-foot level, but we've got consumers on the board, and that was important for us. And they're actually are vocal members. They're not.
So Margie, I guess also what I'm hearing you say is that as medicine or as the medical industrial complex, God, I hate that word. looks at this, that we ought to look at other industries' experiences as well.
Yes, I believe so. We recently did some surveys in the energy industry, and like I said, we found out 50% of the users didn't trust the databases. We were trying to cull down the number of databases and information that was out there by trying to get everyone on one system. But people want access to the information. They want to be able to correct it. Otherwise, they don't believe in the system and don't think it's accurate. I know the medical industry has additional problems where they're administering medication, et cetera. But I think if you get enough of the people on the ground involved, it can be a very successful implementation. We did a very inexpensive implementation recently, and the guys in the field said that we probably saved 90% of their day and time just by having the ability to go to a place where they trusted the information or were at least able to redline it. Mm-hmm.
All right. Thanks very much. Appreciate your call.
Thanks.
You're listening to Line 1, your health connection in Anchorage. Our number is 550-8433, 550-8433, or our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Our email address, line1@kska.org. After this short break, we're going to continue to take your calls and emails and speak with Dr. Jerome List, Dr. Tom Nicewander, and Rebecca Madison on Line 1, your health connection.
If you missed part of today's program, or if you'd like to listen to Line 1, Your Health Connection again, tune in tonight at 8. Remember, tonight's recorded rebroadcast will not be taking telephone calls. Following this afternoon's broadcast, Line 1 will be available on our website at kska.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
This is Line 1, your health connection. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Today my guests are Dr. Jerome List, Dr. Tom Nicewander, and Rebecca Madison. All of these individuals are involved in helping Alaskans bring electronic interconnectivity to healthcare. If you've got questions or comments, email us during the next 30 minutes or so at line1@kska.org, or you can give us a call, 550-8433, our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. And the usual warning, if you're listening between 8 and 9, don't email me, don't call me. You're listening to a taped rebroadcast. And by the way, anytime you want to listen to a previous program, go to kska.org/line1, and you can find the podcast in our records and listen to it at your convenience. You know, one of the big reasons for doing this whole thing is to save money. We're going through some throes in this country to try to make access perhaps better, but there's not a lot being done to save money. I look at this as one of the efforts to save money. Is it gonna save money?
Jerome, you want, Rebecca. We've got some national
not
data.
Not so fast. Yeah. Don't jump up and answer this. Okay.
I think we all have probably our ideas and comments and thoughts about this, and I think that you have to look at this. It's a multifaceted system, but the biggest question and the biggest problem I see is that yes, I think we're going to save money, but the question is who is going to be saving the money, and so people are not incentivated to implement or spend some money to do something that's going to save somebody else money. And so I think that's part of the big picture problem with what we're dealing with. But I think with runaway cost in healthcare and what have you, some of the things that we need to focus on to save money, and I'll just name a few here where I think that technology can help us with, and that would be quality improvement. And basically by providing better quality, we can select test more appropriately for patients and their conditions. I think another big issue that's plagued medicine is redundancy or repeating tests. And so people go to the emergency room and they get a CAT scan, and then they go to the doctor's office 2 days later. They can't find the CAT scan, so they just do another one. There's a tremendous amount of redundancy in overdoing things that have already been done. So those might be two examples of where we could really save some money in healthcare. And we need to do this. I mean, we definitely need to do it.
In the doctor's office, Thad, several of the practices that we're familiar with up here that have actually incorporated using electronic health records, they've actually been able to decrease their staff you know, the filing clerk disappears. Actually, the transcriptionist disappears now. And so at that level, there is savings. But I think Jerome is right in terms of more efficient use of resources. And the reason that could happen is that when built into the electronic health record are online guidelines for a particular disease and what you should and what you shouldn't order, uh-huh. what makes sense, because we do think that there's a lot of overuse, and that's coming out nationally in just the last few weeks. We've been reading about it. So that's one piece. There was some national information, I thought, Rebecca, on cost savings, some estimates that you had at one time.
There have been some studies done, particularly in the number of faxes and copies that have to be made of medical records, that sort of thing. But, you know, it's really hard to say, because you pick up costs in other areas when you move to technology. So you're not really seeing huge savings in, you might see savings in one area, but you're not seeing savings everywhere.
Yeah, and I would, from our programs that we've done on the efforts to change our healthcare system, I would be quick to point out, I think it's accepted that the biggest driver of healthcare costs is new technology. It's new tests, it's new lab, it's new ways to examine the body. And here we're talking about adding some more technology to that. And I'm not trying to be a naysayer. I'm very much in favor of making these changes, and I think there are going to be some hidden changes. But there's clearly some risk out there to this whole thing.
And all three of us have been in this business long enough to talk. We've heard about how the technology is going to reduce costs, and I haven't seen it happen yet. You're absolutely right that. Okay.
Dr. List, do you want to add your wisdom?
I just like to focus in on more specific things, and I think there have been some studies, and people argue, well, it doesn't really save money. People have done studies on how much money it costs to move a chart, to move a paper around the office, and so you eliminate that cost. And so there are some very good studies out there that say that it does reduce cost. And physicians will say, well, the cost of the software and the implementation and the reduced doesn't really, you know, save money. So there are a lot of different factors where you can look at this. And again, I still think that, I mean, it depends on who you save, who you're saving money for is needs to be looked at also. But overall, we're concerned on a national level of the runaway cost of medicine. And if we keep going the way we are, we're not going to be able to afford, you know, medicine in this country. It's going to be our biggest expenditure, and we can't do that. And so we have to start looking at this stuff right now.
We have some examples from Lower 48 and certain health information exchange systems where the hospitals have paid for the whole system because it saved them notifying results information, you know, sending out information to their patient population and others. By combining their efforts and using this technology, they were willing to pay for the whole health information exchange. So the amount of paper that goes out in terms of notification, the way people have been notified in the past, both patients and providers. So there is savings there, but you're right. It's who accumulates, who really sees the savings, and does the system, given the other kinds of expenses. I think the answer is still out there yet. I don't think we know.
One of the things we looked at about in telemedicine was, for instance, if somebody lives in a village and we can do an encounter via internet and we can avert a transfer. In other words, we can take care of that patient's problem in Kotzebue and keep them from coming into Anchorage to have somebody see them here. Well, we've saved the patient a lot of money, a lot of out-of-pocket expense from not coming into Anchorage. But then you start looking at the community as a whole, then the the airline doesn't sell a ticket to have that patient come in, and the industry that goes along with that, and so their revenues decrease and they lose jobs, and so it's a complex formula as to how all this stuff integrates. We have to think of the community as a whole as to really what's happening with the cost of healthcare, and not just penny-pinching here and saving a few dollars there. It's the big picture that I think that really counts, and it's difficult. I mean, everything ties together and everything is interrelated, and so it's very difficult to know how all this stuff. But I think that we as leaders in the healthcare area need to do our job. We need to do our job, and we need to be more efficient, and we need to be more effective in the healthcare that we deliver. We need to deliver higher quality healthcare, and I think that this technology allows us to do all of those things.
Look what's but think what's coming in the future too. A few months ago, I did a complete patient encounter over my iPhone. I got text message from my patient who I happen to know, who sent me her blood pressure readings and that she was out of medicine and whatnot. And I was able to do it all. It was a 5-minute encounter, and I'm sure that in your practice, especially with kids. You know, phone messages, email messages, answering emails, very efficient. Your time, the people don't have to come in, the parents' time, whatnot. We're not reimbursed for that,
right?
You know, it's right. So, but in terms of efficiency, there's no
question.
We're
getting pictures sent to us. I send pictures to another specialist and ask their opinion. I have had videos of sleep disorders sent to me.
Absolutely.
It is. The potential is there for some very neat convenience and good quality at the same time.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. Much better than we've had before. Yeah.
All right. We'll take another caller, and I would like to get back to this issue of cost, and it dawns on me that, you know, quality is one way where it's believed that we could save some costs and that we might want to talk about how this might improve quality. But Mary, first, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
I'm delighted that the medical industry has become technicalized. I'm sorry, I can't make the word come out properly. But when I was younger, I have a very rare type of cancer, and the doctor I was going to at the time misdiagnosed it and put it into his records as I refused chemotherapy and I didn't need it. He had told me that it was a different type of cancer and I didn't need chemotherapy. They did surgery and it was gone. That's all I needed. So come to find out, 4 years later, after another surgery and then another 4 years more surgery, that there was a chemotherapy I did need. It wasn't going to do much good because it was very, very rare. And usually we die within 6 months to 2 years. Anyway, to make a long story short, I take all of my records. I get a copy of everyone that I go to, and I have to go to many doctors. And I make sure I keep them and I read them and make sure that they're correct. I've lived with this cancer now for 29 years.
Excellent.
But it's not over yet. I think you guys are doing a good job. You're either going to lose money in transcriptions or you're going to lose money in technology. Take your pick. However, you have fewer discrepancies when you don't have to worry about data entry because of transcription problems. You know, when you're writing down something, it's easy to reverse a few words here or there, and if you transcribe them onto a recording, then you and actually go onto the computer, you don't have to worry about that.
All right.
So I think that's good.
All right. Thanks very much for your call. I'm glad you hear you're doing well despite another one of those medical screw-ups.
Well, it's okay. You know, it all comes out in the wash. Yeah. And I think as long as all you guys, doctors, nurses, are up on the results of what's happening, then things are going to work out. MD Anderson has a wonderful, wonderful system. They put the records onto the computer, MRIs, CTs, everything, and the doctors from wherever they want, wherever they are, it doesn't matter. You can be here in Alaska, or you can be in the South Pole if you want. They can bring it up on the computer. They don't have to be there. And they can visualize and see exactly what the doctors at MD Anderson have put down.
Well, that's the system we're hoping for, and that's what we're trying to achieve. And I think you speak to Jerome's issue about the quality of the information, and that's exactly where we want to be and where to go.
I think so. I think you're doing a good job. Keep going.
Thanks, Mary.
Thank you.
Thank you. Rebecca, I haven't heard from you for a while, and I want to get back to the quality issue. We're physicians, and how is this going to improve quality? I guess, but the first question is, does quality need to be improved? And then will this help?
I think it will. Definitely having things standardized helps. And if we can create, the more standards we put into this system, the more likely we'll improve quality. Because right now you can have even lab results, for example, reported in multiple different ways. If we can come to an agreement on standards and we can report that out so you could actually trend the lab across time, lab result, we should be able to improve quality considerably. Not only with that, but with tracking for epidemics. We should be able to improve response times to epidemics and things like that. So I think yes. Definitely, information technology will help with quality.
Okay. Any other comments about anything we've talked about so far?
Yeah. One thing that happens is that you automatically, in the electronic medical records I've seen and I have access to, you automatically get reminders on your individual patients of what needs to be done. So in terms of screening, adult immunizations, I'm sure it comes up on the pediatric record that on immunizations for kids, but also things like reminders for colonoscopies and other kind of screening exams that we should do in an adult population. The other big one has been in the pharmacy, where you can now standardize and send electronically, and Jerome does this, your prescription to your pharmacy, it's filled, number one. Number two is, once you've got your patient profile of all the pharmacy that all the drugs the patient has taken, these systems will automatically look for interactions and contraindications to the use of the medication. So that's just built into the system, including, and we've missed it, the allergies that the patient has. Right. And occasionally fortunately, the pharmacist will call me and said, Tom, you've made a mistake. You know, that's this patient you didn't catch, but the patient's allergic to aspirin or allergic to some kind of sulfa drug. Mm-hmm. And so those are automatically built, safeguards that are built into the system. So I think we've got some very practical kinds of applications that will cut down on our error rate.
I got John holding, but a question comes up in my mind. It sounds like the three of us have all used electronic medical records a lot. Would you go back to the way it used
to
be?
No way. No.
Jerome?
Well, Jerome, how long have you had a medical record in your office?
Well, since 1995, and about 2 months ago, I had a very interesting experience where my software company was doing an upgrade, and for some reason there was a glitch with the databases or something. And so, in a nutshell, my system was down for 2 days while they were doing this upgrade, which was unusual. It was the first time it's happened, but I was paralyzed. I didn't know how to function. my hands were tied. It was very, very difficult.
I've been on since 96 and would not go back. And I don't know why I can see going back. And do I think it helps our quality of practice? Absolutely, I think it does.
Absolutely.
John, you're on line one. What can we do for you? Oh, okay. We'll see if he's willing to call back. We have not talked about the physician aspect of this thing, and I want to point out quickly, as physicians who may want to be listening to this later, federal money is available to aid physicians transition to electronic health records. Somebody tell us about this. How's it going? Is it going to work? Sure. You know, is it enough to push the envelope for those physicians who haven't done anything? Rebecca, you want to answer that?
I think it can be a good thing for physicians. There are two different ways they can receive incentive payments for electronic records. One is through Medicaid, and the other is through Medicare. Medicaid provides up to $63,750 over a six-year period, and Medicare up to $48,000. There are some requirements, though. You must be an eligible professional, and you must use certified EHR technology, and you must meet the government's meaningful use criteria. All of those are kind of hard to define because they're not all defined yet. I can just briefly give you some Medicare and Medicaid eligible provider information. It can be a Medicare eligible provider can be a physician, either an MD or a dentist, a podiatrist, optometrist, chiropractor. Hospitals also can receive that funding. And ineligible providers at this time are psychiatrists, rehabilitation, long-term care, children's hospitals, and any of the behavioral health professions and nurses. In Medicaid, similar eligible providers. Medicaid adds nurse practitioners and certified nurse midwives to their list, and they do not have lab techs or chiropractors as eligible. The meaningful use criteria to meet that is supposed to be out by the end of June, although it's looking less and less likely all the time that it'll be quite that quickly. But the federal government insists that they're getting that out soon, and there are 25 different criteria at this time on that list that are being discussed around the nation.
They're practical criteria. Many of them are practical criteria, though. For example, to be able to do e-pharmacy, so to send your prescriptions electronically to the record, to print out vital signs, electronically transmit a billing claim. So they're not really esoteric kinds of requirements to do it. And actually, for this next year in 2011, for the physician community, you will need to have been using electronic health records, I think, for 90 days, and only will have submitted, actually, I believe, Rebecca, one medical record. You know, electronically. So
correct for the first payment.
That was the first. That was stage one. Stage two in 2012. The criteria goes up, but for the first stage, at least, it's fairly modest. And one of our physicians, I just got a note from one of our physicians. He will be eligible for meaningful use here in another couple of months, and will beat the deadline of 2011.
I always liked it. Go ahead.
And the certified EHR technology one is kind of questionable, too, right now. There was originally a certification board that was certifying these EHRs, and they have since said they're going to change that certification. So it looks like it's going to be less stringent than the CCHIT certification, which was the original. So most people probably will have EHRs that are certified if they've already installed them.
I always like to think about the healthcare system as involving three big parties: the healthcare, whoever's paying the bill, the physicians, and then the patients. And we've concentrated on the physicians to a large degree. We haven't talked about how this might impact patients a lot. We have talked about safety, but what about healthcare, the insurance industry? Will it increase the likelihood that as a provider of any sort, we're going to have information about what's covered at the time of service, you know, that kind of thing, which could save some money, and looking at how insurance companies are really functioning a little bit better from a safety, cost-effectiveness standpoint for patients.
Good. Jerome, you want to?
Well, I think that's a very complex question, actually, but Insurance companies obviously play a big role in the healthcare system of this country. And one of the reasons why I think that healthcare reform has been challenging and difficult is because there are so many different aspects to healthcare. And insurance is obviously a very big part of this. Insurance companies have had a leg up on all the rest of us for a long time because they own a lot of data. They have a lot of information. And so I think this is one of the selling points that I utilize, that is, we have to start utilizing this information that we're gathering, because it helps us know what we're doing. It helps us know where we're coming from and where we're going as far as quality. But insurance companies have not been very willing to share the information because it's powerful information. But insurance companies have a lot of information. I think sharing clinical information will be a big advantage to everybody. That's why we've tried to endorse some of the insurance companies into our organizations, to have them be part of this. This is complex, and we need to have all the involved parties involved in the development of this. But information is powerful, and insurance companies have a lot of it.
Just in fairness, at the local level, Thad, Premera has been a very active member of the board, and then our second probably biggest payer has been state Medicaid, mm-hmm. and they are the state is well represented on the board of directors. So
we have 2 minutes left, and you know we've been knocking physicians. Okay, that's fair. Everybody knocks the insurance company, so I'm not trying to be cruel here. Yeah. I want to be fair, but there was an article in the paper, I think just recently, about the costs of non-compliance with healthcare, mm-hmm. and not filling prescriptions, not following through with prescriptions. Mm-hmm. I think this, well, certainly in the Native hospital, you know if someone fills their prescription or not. Yeah. Are we going to achieve that level of understanding and get to the point where we can address that issue as well?
I think so. Jerome, you're using the e-prescribing now.
The e-prescribing, but I might...
Can you tell if the patient's picked up the prescription?
No, I can't. Not with my current system right now, even though the future development of this would be a two-way highway. But I think it's more than just picking up the prescription. I think it's... I think a big part of what our role is today in medicine is educating people. If they don't understand why they're going to take the medicines, and I think that this technology helps us better educate patients.
That's a good point. Yeah.
And so education is a very, very important part of this whole process. Mm-hmm. And excuse me for digressing here just a little bit, but I think education is very, very important. I think the technology, it's another area that helps us really accomplish providing, delivering good health care. If patients are not involved, I mean, I think it's not just an issue of knowing where they picked up the prescriptions. Why didn't they pick up the prescription?
Absolutely.
Was it a financial reason, or is it because they didn't believe in what you were giving them, or they didn't understand why you were giving it to them? Yeah. So I think education is very, very important.
Yeah. Can't afford it.
I mean, then. That's true. That's true. Right.
Rebecca, any comments? We got about 30 seconds here.
I think Jerome is right. I think education is a big part of that. And one of the things that this does do by giving patients access to the system allows us to also give them access to information which can help them with their disease. So I would absolutely agree with that, that's as important as anything.
All right. So I don't know. I can sum up. I think we're moving in the right direction. It's time we started doing it. It's not easy. We all have some responsibility for healthcare costs. My thanks to the representatives of Alaska Electronic Health Record Alliance and Alaska eHealth Network, Rebecca Madison, Jerome List, Tom Nicewander. It's been a wonderful hour. We'll return next week when we're going to be discussing newer developments in multiple sclerosis with Barbara Geiser. She's a clinical professor of neurology and the director of the multiple sclerosis program at UCLA. She's been caring for patients with multiple sclerosis since 1982. Pat Yak is Vice President of APTI News and Public Media. David helped me engineer today's program, and I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1, Your Health Connection, is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available on our website at kska.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.